I'm Eric Doherty. I'm a transportation planning consultant, and I live in Victoria on Lekwungen territory. And I'm also a co-chair of Greater Victoria Acting Together's Climate Justice Action Research Team.
From the traditional territories of the Lekwungen and Wasanich peoples on southern Vancouver Island, I'm Dean Murdoch, and this is Amazing Places.
Welcome to the podcast, Eric. It's a delight to have you here. I was so thrilled to read your recent op-ed in the Capital Daily. You focused in that one on rapid transit, so I thought maybe that'd be a great place for us to start. But, you know, transportation in the Capital Region is such a significant issue that I imagine we're going to have quite a bit to cover in today's discussion. So why don't we start there? Why don't you tell us a little bit about, tell us a little bit about the organization that you are a part of, on whose behalf you were speaking in that op-ed, and then let's talk a little bit about what you had to say in the op-ed.
Thanks, Dean. First of all, Greater Victoria Acting Together, or GVAT, is a fairly new organization that brings together over 30 organizations in the region representing over 100,000 people. That includes all of the members of the UVic and Camosun College student societies, a whole bunch of religious institutions, unions, service organizations, and the Sierra Club of BC. And getting into transportation issues, I think that this rapid bus proposal is a really crucial one, because it actually it's really the perfect alternative to highway expansion. And in this region, most of the money from the federal and provincial governments in recent decades has been going into highway expansion. You know, we've seen 80 some million dollar project, highway expansion project on Silk Road underway, the $100 million McKenzie Interchange. And if you go back a bit to that wonderful in McTavish Interchange at the highway, where with the double traffic circle that everybody loves so much, that was actually, you know, during the federal election, the majority of the money for that boondoggle came from the federal government.
So blacktop politics is alive and well in an era where, you know, we have so much awareness about not just traffic congestion, but the vehicle emissions and their contribution to climate change, and which we are experiencing more intensely, I think, now than we ever have, and it's going to get that much worse. So what do you think is going on there? Why has it continued to be a priority for senior governments to fund these car-oriented infrastructure projects?
I think there's a few things going on that some of them are just, you know, very simple human reluctance to change. Governments have been, you know, the same departments have been expanding highways since World War II. And so there's a fair bit of momentum there that needs to be changed. And that, you know, that requires a bit of effort of change. But there's also powerful constituencies. Big oil is the biggest one. The Koch brothers have had a anti-transit, pro-highway expansion campaign across North America for over a decade. And the fight is more intense in the US, but it, of course, that comes across the border. And then there's, you know, there's people who make money off this, car dealers, property speculators out in the suburbs who want to pave over some farmland or cut down a forest for a low density housing development. All of these constituencies profit, even though these highway expansions, everybody knows you can't build your way out of congestion. It's referred to as induced traffic. Whenever you build highway or increase highway capacity in whatever way in an urban region, it just fills up, greenhouse gas pollution increases, and traffic gets worse. So, if you think about the McKenzie Interchange, we just spent $100 million to make traffic worse and increase greenhouse gas pollution. But a whole bunch of, property developers, for all the years that this was being talked about and built, they were able to kind of spin this as, oh, traffic's going to get better. Come and buy buy a house in this subdivision that doesn't even have sidewalks. And so it's a tricky thing, but it's also something that is right at this moment, we can change it. There's a very broad public awareness that there's a climate emergency. There's a broad public awareness that cars and pickup trucks and sports utility vehicles are a huge part of why we're in this climate emergency, why the province is on fire, why people are dying from heat stroke in Victoria, of all places. People are ready for this change. And that's particularly younger people. And I'm going to, being kind of an old fart, I'm going to identify that younger, the people whose attitudes towards cars is considerably different than the boomers. That includes pretty much everybody under 50 years old. That it's like the majority of the population is not of a car loving generation that grew up in the muscle car era. 20 years ago, the people who were emotionally attached to their cars, who weren't interested in any other way of getting around, whose status was really tied to their automobiles, that was a really, really huge percentage of the population. But most of those people now are in their late 60s through to their mid 70s. And they're not as status driven as they used to be. And more importantly, they're not driving nearly as much.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're also bearing the brunt of increasing fuel costs and traffic congestion and experiencing a rapidly accelerating changing climate and its harsher effects here, well, all over the world, but here in the capital region too, as you said, incredibly, people dying due to the heat in a place that's known for having a temperate climate.
Like who would have ever thought that it would be uncomfortably hot in Fairfield?
Unimaginable.
It's just like that. That is something I just never conceived of.
So you describe rapid transit as being the perfect alternative to highway development. And I think for most people listening to this podcast, they probably understand that just intuitively, but certainly by their lived experience, even traveling to other parts of the world, other parts of the country, that there are viable alternatives to moving people. Why do you think that it represents that alternative, the perfect alternative?
Well, the rapid bus proposal is from BC Transit. It covers both of the main highways, the Pat Bay Highway and the highway route to the West Shore, to Langford and Colwood. So it's like, we're a small region. We only have two traffic jams, and only one of them is particularly bad. And so it covers the two main highways. And it is also something that just like highways, because it's bus, it can be built in chunks that are like a highway project. You know, a highway interchange, a big one or a medium-sized one like McKenzie is $100 million. You can do a lot with bus rapid transit for $100 million. The Keating flyover, $30 or $40 million. Similarly, you can do an awful lot on the Pat Bay Highway for bus lanes for $30 or $40 million. So every time one of these highway expansion boondoggles comes onto the political radar, we can say, well, let's compare what this would do, what we could do for bus rapid transit in this region for that same price tag. And every time it's going to come out that, yeah, well, for example, like the current one, I think, is this Keating flyover. You know, it's like that's something where there's a safety problem that could be solved with the traffic light cheaply. And then you'd have $30 million, $40 million left over to put in the sections of a bus lane and the signal priority that BC Transit says they need on the Pot Bay Highway. And yeah, so it's one of these things where it's like it's a perfect comparator. You know, I love rail transit. I love light rail. I love metros like SkyTrain, but those are big capital projects. Mm-hmm. And it makes, you can't build, you know, 5 kilometers of light rail line and make it have it make sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to get the $1 billion to build the whole line all at once. And that was something that the region tried and failed at. But I also think that electric buses are making a huge difference. Mm-hmm. We're now in a situation where even for the really demanding routes like the number 50, which is the first rapid bus line that BC Transit wants to build from the legislature to Langford, the busiest bus route in the region, there's electric buses that can do that route reliably that you can purchase right now. But of course, what do you need to do that? You need money.
And so it then falls to our representatives at the local level to work with senior governments to say, you know, we want to reprioritize the funding that's arriving here in the capital. Not that, you know, the argument that we're not getting our fair share, rather, we want to think differently about how these dollars get invested so that they can create the most efficient way to move people.
Exactly. Exactly. It's the reprioritization of resources, because I think it's really important to recognize that the majority of the transportation infrastructure money that's coming to the region is actually doing harm. So it's in order to meet our climate targets, in order to become a healthier region, to become a more affordable region, we need to actually stop that harm. So this idea that it's okay to keep building highways as long as we can get other money for transit, it just doesn't wash in the climate emergency. In this era, we need to, do what we did in World War II. You know, we shifted what, because it was acknowledged as an emergency, we stopped doing a whole bunch of stuff and reprioritized resources to get the essentials done, which was, at that time, it was war.
Yeah.
It was war and it was food production. You know, we built ships and we shipped wheat. Those kinds of things. We need to recalibrate what our society does and actually, stop doing the harmful stuff and free up the workers, the materials, the machines, all the things to do the necessary good stuff.
Well, and you know, you mentioned World War II and this kind of remarkable period where government pivoted quickly in order to be responsive to the emergency. We don't even have to go back in history to see that government is capable of doing exactly that. We're living it, you know, through this pandemic, through this, the threat to public health, a public health emergency. All levels of government worked very quickly to be responsive and poured billions of dollars into shoring up the economy and making sure people remained safe and could do the things that were required in order for them to stop the spread of this virus. We're also in a different couple of different kinds of emergencies, right? We're in the midst of a climate emergency. We're in a housing emergency in terms of affordability for folks. I see no reason why we can't create the same level of responsiveness in these crises. We're clearly capable of doing it. It's just a matter of expecting better, asking for governments to be responsive to these other crises that clearly have not had the same level of focus.
Yeah, and that is the great thing, is that we've got this example that society has made. You know, we've made changes that were unthinkable. What governments did in the pandemic was not in their pandemic plans. It went well beyond what was in the pandemic plans. And there's, you know, there's other countries that have been far more successful that did even more unthinkable things, like New Zealand, who kept their death and disability rate from COVID very, very low, despite not having good access to vaccines, good early access to vaccines. So we can do it. That's the thing. We can do it. And I think crucially, like particularly for Greater Victoria Acting Together, which is, you know, very much a social justice group, the fact is that these changes are going to make life more affordable and more just for ordinary people. Because it's not just that we've got a housing crisis. We've got a housing and transportation affordability crisis. Because right now, you can drive to qualify. In this region, you can go out and find, drive 45 minutes past Souk. You can probably find a place to rent that it seems affordable. But it's actually, if you have to work in Saanich or Victoria, your overall costs, if you're driving in every day, your overall costs are going to be higher living way out in the ex-urban areas than they are living closer to work, where you can live without a car, or if you're a family, maybe you can live with one car easily and comfortably. Rather than, you know, I've talked to people out in the West Shore communities whose families own four cars. Mm-hmm. So four cars minimum. That's like if you do some of your own repairs, you're still talking about $5,000 or $6,000 a year to own a used car if you're using it regularly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who are very busy and end up buying bigger vehicles, new bigger vehicles, they're spending over $12,000 a year just for one vehicle. Mm-hmm.
On the premise that it's cheaper to buy a house out there, and yet their immediate costs are going to rise just by virtue of having to get to where they need to go.
Yes, and their costs go up, and also there's the time cost. Mm-hmm. They're ending up having to spend large amounts of time driving, which is different than being on transit. You know, you can't, you know, when you're driving, you can't pay attention to a phone call. Mm-hmm. You can't retweet Dean's latest great tweet. at least not safely. That's part of the problem, is that people are trying to do these things whilst they drive.
And it's a stress-inducing experience, right? We know that, you know, having to go through that sort of internal battle, activating your fight or flight as you're making your way through traffic, is not good for our mental health. And then, you know, the longer we sit in vehicle traffic, the more detrimental it is to our physical health, because it's time where we're not up and moving around.
Yeah, I actually like driving if I can be out driving on a, you know, on a uncongested, or, you know, even a highway that's a little bit congested. I kind of like it, but I also find it really exhausting.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it's not like sitting on a bus for an hour. It's draining.
So speaking of being able to sit on a bus for an hour, which I think would be the longer version of a journey in the capital region, there's not a lot of places where people are headed that it's going to take them an hour, especially if it's a rapid bus service. There are more than just these major spines, thoroughfares, as part of that plan for rapid transit. So we're not just talking about the highways. There's more to it than that in terms of what BC Transit envisions for the capital region.
There is. And there are other rapid bus lines that are proposed, one from downtown to UVic. But I think also it's we need to be thinking about the whole region, and we need to be thinking about improving public transit for the whole region, including ensuring that ordinary buses are not stuck in traffic to the extent that they are now. And I really think that we can look to leading cities around the world. Every kind of climate leading city, you know, Mexico City, Bogota, Paris, they're all putting in bus lanes all over the place. They're putting in some big, you know, main route rapid bus lines, but they're also putting in short lengths of what's referred to as a queue jumper lane, with transit signal priority, which is just a traffic light that lets the bus go first ahead of the cars. They're doing that region-wide, wherever there is the space and the need. And that is really the thing that we need to be thinking about, is making that our transit system really desirable 7 days a week for multiple kinds of trips. Switching to electric buses, which are so much quieter than the diesel buses. I'm thinking about being particularly for transit riders. You know, I've lived in Vancouver, and those electric trolley buses are such a joy to ride on compared to the noisy diesel buses. Mm-hmm. Particularly if you're sitting at the back, you know, where the engine is on a diesel bus, they're, even the new ones are pretty noisy. And, but also for the people in the streets, the people who live along bus lines, that transition to electric buses is going to make our whole region so much nicer. And so we need more buses, we need electric buses. And right now all the transit depots are jammed. They don't have room for extra buses. They're already spending a lot of staff time shuffling buses around because the depots are overcrowded. And in Saanich, there's a big piece of land that BC Transit has bought for a new transit depot. Near the postal sorting area on Van Almen, the Canada Post depot, and I don't know the budget of that project, but I suspect that to build that depot and to have electric charging infrastructure put in there for electric buses is going to be $100 million, mm-hmm. something in that order. And so we need for, you know, just for the depot and the charging infrastructure, we probably need the equivalent of a McKenzie interchange of investment. And that is, but that's something that would make a huge difference for the region. Mm-hmm. Huge improvement rather than making things worse.
Well, and, you know, by introducing that level of service along these significant corridors, it actually helps municipalities, the local governments that will be paying, at least in partnership with senior governments, if not entirely, for these kinds of investments. Creating that certainty along those corridors allows them to achieve some of their housing goals. It allows them to concentrate density in those areas where we know people will have confidence that they can hop on a bus. And even if it's just a 5-minute journey to get up the road, the bus will be in that lane to pick them up and drop them off. And therefore, you know, along with that density comes the property tax revenue that will help pay for some of those investments.
Yeah, and that is one of the nasty things about all this money going into highway expansion, because every time you spend $100 million on highway expansion, you're actually hurting. And even though most of these projects, there's no municipal money goes into it, no CRD money. It's all federal and provincial money, except for minor things around the edges to local roads. It because it induces sprawl and makes densification harder, it hurts municipal finances. Every time you build a highway, you increase the resistance, right, to higher density development in established areas, because the biggest reason that people resist any kind of infill, more people, it's not more people that they're objecting, it's more cars. So if we've got a better transit system, we've got a situation where the resistance to higher density, more affordable housing is going to be reduced. It won't go away, but the big top reason that people object to having higher density housing will wane, because we'll actually be able to say, guess what? There's fewer cars in the region this year than there were last year. There's less driving, there's lower vehicle kilometers traveled on the main routes. We can measure this. And we're going to do this in the future. So just because there's an apartment building going in down the block from you that doesn't have any parking except for two disabled spots, that doesn't mean that your whole neighborhood is going to be flooded with cars. Mm-hmm. Because we've got a situation where not just the people in those apartment buildings, but your neighbors, yourself, may decide that you don't need that second car.
And we're, by concentrating more of that density, and, you know, we're talking about gentle density. We're not talking about building these monster high rises along every corridor. It's going to help prevent the further deforestation and, you know, blowing up mountainsides that we've seen go on in some of the West Shore communities, where housing is being built, but it's coming at a significant cost in terms of our environmental and ecosystems. So you layer on the fact that you're not putting people in their vehicles, contributing to greenhouse gas emissions. You're putting them in closer proximity to the goods, services, and places they need to get to. So you're lowering their traveling costs. And at the same time, we're hanging on to some of those natural features which make this such a viable destination to begin with, that we will not continue to see these beautiful landscapes that contribute so much to our ecosystem, quality of life, and cleaning the congested air that we breathe. by allowing some of that density to start to shift in back into the core areas where people are able to get around without their vehicle, and they can rely on quality transit and active transportation in order to get around.
Yeah, and that's actually something that the CRD Transportation Priorities Report covers. And that's something that it came from discussion at the CRD Transportation Committee and board level, was the initial report talked about improving parking supply at parks, increasing parking supply at parks. The directors changed that and unanimously agreed that what we need is to improve multimodal access to parks. And a lot of people don't realize that already a lot of people are accessing our parks by transit, by cycling, by walking, mobility scooters, and they're doing it in a situation where that hasn't been a priority in the region. It hasn't really been a priority in the region, for example, to have good bus service to Beacon Hill Park or Mount Doug Park or East Souk Park. And if we're going to be living in a region that has a lot of people who are choosing to live without cars and just have that, you know, the moto car membership, one of the things we need to do is create a transit system that works 7 days a week, and in particular, that gets you to the place where you want to go for a hike on Sunday afternoon. And no, not every time, because people are going to, you know, that's what moto, the car share is for going out to the, you know, the places where there's never going to be good transit service to. But, you know, just as an example, I think that within a couple of years, it's going to be quite feasible to take the bus to East Souk Park, go for a long hike, come out at a different trailhead, and catch another bus home. And this is something that Greater Victoria Acting Together has on our priority list, is to make it so that people can legally use mobility scooters and wheelchairs on the all ages and abilities cycling and rolling routes. You can already use a skateboard, a bicycle on these routes. You can already use an e-bike, but because of the antiquated Motor Vehicle Act, it's technically seems to be illegal to use a mobility scooter or a power wheelchair on these routes. The act has actually been amended in the House, but only to allow pilot projects. And because there's no pilot projects that have started, the cabinet hasn't enacted the amendments. So we're gonna be going to the City of Victoria and the District of Saanich to request that that there be a pilot project just focused on mobility scooters and wheelchairs, getting them access to those supposedly all ages and abilities cycling routes.
How do folks get involved with Greater Victoria Acting Together?
You go to our website, gvat.ca.
Eric Doherty is the co-chair of the Climate Justice Action Research Team with the Greater Victoria Acting Together. We've had a delightful discussion just on rapid transit alone, and just touched on the ability to get around for folks who need to use our roadway infrastructure for other purposes not considered in the Motor Vehicle Act. Eric, I know we could carry on at length on all of these topics, and I'd love to have you back for that discussion. But I, for now, we'll wrap things up, and I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to share your insights and knowledge about how we improve transportation for the folks who live in the capital region and those who will live in the capital region.
Thanks very much, Dean. It's been a pleasure.
This has been another episode of Amazing Places. I'm Dean Murdoch. Thanks for listening.